back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams and my co-host. And I have to tell you guys, you know, we're carrying this conversation over. And normally we don't do that at the top of the hour, but I think it is really important that we do. Because KJ and the points that he's making really, I think, are at the root of what is happening in this country, where we have Americans who believe that it is our responsibility to defend democracy all over the world. Never mind that we're only 4% of the global population. And that it, because somewhere along the road, Sandy, people in this nation who are in charge of it agree with KJ and others, because we've got all those military bases all over the world.
Well, yeah.
Somewhere along the line, there's somebody who agrees with KJ that our responsibility is.
Well, lots of people agree, and it kind of came out during the Clinton administration. When the Soviet Union fell apart, and surprisingly, there wasn't any conflict between Russia and the other republics. And in fact, one of the reasons, just historically, there wasn't that conflict is because we were assuring Gorbachev at the time that we would not spread NATO, that we would leave Russia with its hegemony over this area so that they did not need to worry about the independent republics of the old USSR, because we would continue to leave Russia as the kind of lead role in that hegemonic region, which then, of course, we stopped doing with NATO. But at that time, we developed this theory of Pax Americana. It was the neoconservative internationalist theory, which was it was America's place as the sole superpower of the world to police the world and make sure it was the rule of order was in place and the rule of democratic order was implemented.
And we accepted that.
Well, we just implicitly adopted that. And now the neoliberals have sort of adopted that same principle, even though the world has evolved. The world now has other superpowers, China. Russia has re-evolved into a superpower. We have plenty of nations with nuclear capacity. And we have, meanwhile, flexed our muscle in 2000 and, in the Iraq War and in the Afghanistan War, much to our dismay. It was done badly. And it was not done really to police democracy. And it turns out that where we have flexed our muscle has not spawned democracy. We have not done nation building. We have only picked and chosen where we are active. It doesn't tend to have a great deal to do with democracy, and has more to do with natural resources, apparently. But the fact is that the American population basically agrees with KJ, and I guess I'm not a lone voice, but you and I hope are talking about this, helping people think this one through and to think differently. There are those in Congress who are thinking differently. There are those on the right, Rand Paul. There are those on the left, on the progressive movement, who are thinking differently. And my hope is that more and more people will start thinking independently. I accused the fellow from Sturgeon Bay of drinking the Kool-Aid.
Right.
I think we've all drunk the Kool-Aid, and it all came out of sort of a Cold War way of thinking. Incidentally, during the Cold War, we countenanced a great deal of non-democratic activity. We agreed with the Warsaw Pact nations and the Iron Curtain. That was all done based on our complicity. We agreed to that in the Yalta agreements.
So, Sandy, I push back on that way of thinking. Because we do that at the expense of the American people. So we tell the American people to tighten their belts, and we can't do anything to help you because we don't have any money, but yet we can spend the money on those types of things. That's why I continue to push back on it, because this is not benefiting the American people. What are we doing this for, Sandy?
Well, one of the problems is by ignoring the needs of the American people, our democracy is frayed. Okay,
right.
And by frayed, I mean tattered. It's at risk. Our society is becoming polarized. It's becoming non-functional. We have serious problems inside our country. And if we think that we are better off spending our money on preserving what exactly kind of government it is for Taiwan and not preserving our own safety and internal security, comfort, and livelihoods of Americans, I just have trouble understanding. We seem to think that democracy over there is more important than democracy here, and frequently the democracy over there isn't anywhere near the version that ours is. For instance, the Ukrainian democracy is fraught with corruption, and more people are talking about that in our Congress. And we've always known this before the Ukrainian Russian-Ukrainian war, and now during it. We've sent them over $100 billion, and there will be an audit someday, but I'm sure the audit will be as inconclusive and as difficult to carry out as the audit of the Defense Department, which incidentally has gotten nowhere.
You know, Sandy, again, looking from inside of our borders at what is happening, as you so stated so rightly, in the rural areas that we talk about constantly, and in the cities, and we know what people we don't even have clean water in this country. People are drinking leaded water, and we're accepting all of those things because we say we can't afford it. And yet we're going to continue because we're worried about the democracy halfway around the world in these other places. And the fact that we have all of these military installation bases, and it's really time to start shutting down many of those, as you stated. So what if Russia spends more time and focuses more on what's happening around Russia? What's wrong with China being more concerned about what happens in the immediate vicinity of where China is? Why is that? Why are we there? We don't need to be there. We can't afford to be there. And so maybe decades ago we could, Sandy, but today we certainly cannot.
Oh, there certainly are red lines we can draw, and those red lines don't have anything to do with the kind of money we're currently spending. We certainly believe that Australia is sacrosanct, okay? But China's, like the premier of Australia said, you know, China's not going to invade Australia. The reason he knows is that he has a brain and he uses it. It's not going to happen. But you know, we do need to have a military that is capable of doing the things that are, you know, sacred to America's interests and in our defense. But we don't need to have the military we currently have, which is capable of conducting essentially offensive wars in three fronts around the world. And you know, people can say, well, they're defensive, but we don't have defensive military. We have the capacity of carrying out offensives. And by offensives, I mean warfare in distant places, okay? That's an offensive war. A defensive war is a war where you're protecting your shores. And we don't even worry about that.
Right. You know, Sandy, I want to move on. Our phone line's open, as always, at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You know, Sandy, this conversation, Biden is too old and not especially popular. He's way too old. You and I were talking about Mitch McConnell, who is almost the same age as Joe Biden, right? And so there's talk about maybe Mitch McConnell, you know, may be thinking about retirement based on the fact that he just had this horrible fall and suffered some trauma. And then you look at Dianne Feinstein and you look at over and over and over people who, kind of fair to say,
Senator Grassley?
Yes, Chuck Grassley. Yeah. Kind of overstayed their welcomes. And what are your thoughts? You know, you can't make people retire. You remember Strom Thurmond and what was the guy's name?
Helms?
Jesse Helms and the other guy who used to be a a Republican but turned Democrat, and he stayed till it was 100 years recently, maybe 10, 15 years, 20 years ago.
Byrd.
Senator. Yeah, Senator Robert Byrd.
Robert Byrd.
These people almost into 100, Sandy.
Well, you know, incumbency gives you power. And if you're unwilling, if you get off on power and having it, then you don't want to yield it. And this is, again, now these people are older than baby boomers. But the fact is that the boomer generation is doing just what those people are doing, which is we're keeping a grip on power as long as we can, and we're depriving of those behind us of the capacity to move into this power and to bring their outlook into the position of power. And, it needs to happen.
But it's inevitable. They're going to eventually take the thrones anyway.
Well, if the boomer generation and those older, the silent generation if we hold on to power long enough, it'll skip a generation. And and the next generation to come into power won't be our children. It'll be our grandchildren.
Well, you know.
It's what's happening.
That can happen. Yeah. I mean, so. So what are your thoughts? I mean, how do you address it? I mean, because you can't move them out. Dianne Feinstein is a prime example into her 90s. Clearly, she is way beyond lucid, right? It's kind of safe to say that. I haven't seen her.
I don't want to speak to that, but I will speak to the fact that apparently she's absent a great deal and not available for votes. Currently, the shingles problem has caused her to be absent at a time when her vote on the Judiciary Committee would be important for judicial appointments. She seems to be well past the age where someone should maybe say it's time for someone else to take my role. California, it's a safe Democratic seat. It's not like if she gave up her seat, she'd be likely yielding it to the other party. And if she was a party loyalist, that might give her pause. But that's not the case.
Well, we saw that with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, right?
Supreme Court.
Yeah, the Supreme Court. And so we're at a point, we got to go to break. 844-967-2789. What say you? We'll be right back. So... Show as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host Sandy Williams. What happened, man? What was the name of the university? I just said it.
Cardinal Stritch.
Cardinal Stritch.
Yeah.
Is no more.
I mean, that was like there was like a firecracker going off in the backyard. What was that noise? You know, they run out of business. I don't think the world around Milwaukee had any sense that Cardinal Stritch was in such a fragile position. It's got a bunch of graduate students, undergraduate. Its enrollment was going down. It's got that bunch of new buildings, campuses up there on Glendale or Fox Point, wherever that's located.
So why were they building the new buildings when they knew that their enrollment was...
Well, I think the enrollment is... There's been a... Ever since the pandemic
from
and before...
From 5,000 down to...
Yeah, it's kind of gone off a cliff in a sort of a rapid way. And some of it has to do with the shrinking population of people in college age. It's every private school in the country is going to face this problem, and particularly the ones that are so-called tuition-driven, the ones that don't have an endowment and simply rely on each student's tuition each year as the way they meet their budget. So you can see that if that's the way you operate, if you go from 5,000 students to 2,500 students, your revenue drops in half, but your costs don't drop in half. And so, you know, you get into a real cost squeeze. I've been on the board of a couple of private universities, and one of them in particular was very tuition-driven. So I understand kind of how that works. And schools now today are trying to position themselves in a way that it's essentially a marketing problem. Are we providing a product to a student that will cause them to come here? And they need to get a growing percentage of the remaining pool to stay in business, because the pool of kids going to college is going down. The population of them is going down. But furthermore, as you and I were talking about off the air, college is no longer a guarantee to a job. And so more and more people are beginning to consider, properly so probably, the technical college alternative, the trade alternative, the apprentice alternative, things that will move them into, in today's world, quite high-paid jobs, I mean, well above the median income. Median income, 75. People who go to work in the trades today can expect to earn over $100,000 a year.
Sandy, so let's talk about the crises that is on the way at universities across this nation, because, again, the baby boomers aren't coming back.
Right.
They're less and less.
Well, and the millennial bulge has gone through, and it turns out the millennials aren't having children at the same rate. And then the young people today are having even a lower fertility rate. So the projection of college-age kids is on a downward trajectory.
So universities, they got to be aware of this.
Well, they certainly are. And, of course, public universities have a lower tuition issue, and they're able to attract students and are more certain of futures, although you can see in the UW system they're actively now recalibrating which schools do we keep open, which ones do we close, they're looking at it carefully.
So on a major higher education platform, these major universities have to be looking at all of these things and saying, hey, at some point in time, in the near future, what are we going to do?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they've got these campuses that are spectacular. Some of them are still building all these amenities, Sandy, to try to get their share of what's left?
I mean, there's the cream of the crop in colleges, the ones that we've nationally all heard the names of.
Let's go to break, and then we'll hit it on the other side. All right, we'll be right back.
Like you need a house and a home, baby.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Wade. And Sandy, this is one of those topics, man, that, you know, people are thinking about who are in education business. But maybe, you know, the average person, you know, we're not thinking about it. But at some point in time, this nation is going to, that's a reckoning.
Oh, yeah.
That is coming.
And, you know, that when people are investing a fair amount of money personally in going to school, they have a vested interest in that school thriving and continuing. You know, you don't want to be a junior in a school and find out it's going out of business. I mean, that's what is happening at Cardinal Stritch, right? There's people who are midway through their degree program and whoops, it's gone.
Well, let me.
And, you know, what's happening in the world is there's this consolidation in the private school industry. And the ones that are unendowed and are tuition driven are fragile. If you talk to students, young people today who are on the verge of going to college, they're either fighting hard to get into a name school out there, a Notre Dame, an USC, an Ivy League school, Vanderbilt, you know, the schools that we all know the names of,
right. Okay,
Northwestern, or they're working hard to get into the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You have to be in the top quarter of your class at least and test well to go there. Or they're going to go to a UW state system school, okay? But they aren't looking at going to, many of them, when you talk to them, are not going to go to a school that's a small school, unendowed in another state or even maybe in Wisconsin. They're no longer so much on the table. They have to have a real value proposition to present to the student and their family in order to compel them to go off and spend the money on the tuition to go there. And so, yeah, there's a fragility. You know, we've got schools like Carthage College, and I'm not saying this with any knowledge, I'm not trying to scare anybody,
but
schools of that profile, okay, have got to be schools that are worried about the future with respect to the dwindling number of students, just like Jay Rothman, the new head of the UW system, is having to spend a great deal of attention trying to figure out how to shape Wisconsin's university system for this new future.
So Sandy, we're here in Waukesha. Concordia College is right around the corner, right?
Concordia's in Mequon.
I mean, not Concordia. What's the name of the?
Carroll College.
Carroll College.
Yes.
Carroll College. Right here in Waukesha. And it's a major part of Waukesha, right?
Yeah, and Carroll College has an endowment. It's an old school, dates all the way back to the statehood period. It has evolved, though. It used to be strictly a liberal arts school. Now it has a nursing school. It has a bunch of schools that are intended to prepare you directly for a job.
But I'm just using Carroll because if you move across the state, there are other smaller universities that are a key part of the towns that they're in, right?
Yes.
And if you pull those out of some of the towns kind of collapse, right?
Well, certainly the flavor of the town changes and collapses. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had, Wisconsin had a tradition of these small schools, and most of them still exist, Ripon College, Beloit College, Lawrence College, Carroll College.
Right.
These were all kind of renowned, even beyond the boundaries of Wisconsin, renowned small liberal arts colleges. But small liberal arts colleges are under pressure.
And that there was certainly a need for those universities a while back. The question becomes now, is there a need for them anymore? As many of them that there are. And again, what do they do? They knew, Sandy, that Stritch knew it was in that kind of a condition. And you're not going to pull the plug right in the middle of it. I mean, they knew 3-4 years ago, 5 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, that they were facing these difficult.
Well, you know, I think it's much like America. You put your head in the sand about the problem you've got day after tomorrow, and you operate as optimistically as you can, and you just operate on the premise that you're going to stay in business. The boards of directors of these places are volunteer folks.
Right.
Who are doing their best, but you know they tend to be cheerleaders for their institution. That's one of the problems with something like private education is that it's hard for them to wake up and accept the realities they face, they want to put their head in the sand and pretend that it's not going to happen.
Can you do that in business?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like I said, these are not for profit businesses, and these places are doing the best they can with the resources they can, but right. ultimately it's all based on fundraising. Okay, it's based on fundraising. It's also based on presenting providing an academic product and having an academic image that puts you in demand amongst the students and their families. And the only problem now is that there's a dwindling, that's a pool that's getting smaller and smaller. So it gets harder and harder, even if you continue to get your little percentage of that pool. When the pool gets smaller, your number gets smaller. So what most of these schools have to do is to get an increasing percentage of the pool of potential applicants in order to stay in business and thrive. And so that means that they can't keep doing what they are doing. They have to do more because they have to have an image that provides them with an increasing percentage of the pool.
So they're forced to build a better Coliseum, or so to speak, or
yeah,
you know, and that's not what they're in business to do anyway, but they've got to build something to offer to bring someone there, right? I mean, many of those universities, they have, you know, they provide, I guess, some athletic activities even in the level to what they are, but they've got to have a nice amenity even with that, right? I mean, they're under stress.
Well, they just have to figure out what their path is, okay? And schools are increasingly doing that. Like I said, Carroll College has developed finance programs. It's moved out of liberal arts per se in providing training for things like nursing and things like that, which is an evolution which is designed to give them an increasing part of that pool of potential applicants. And that's what schools are going to have to do. So it's a marketplace. It's a competitive marketplace. It's increasingly competitive for these schools. It's interesting because the schools that have big names have more applicants than they know what to do with. And the schools that don't have that same kind of reputation, the private schools, are suffering a dwindling pool. So it's several worlds that these places exist in.
You know, Sandy, so what we're seeing all over the nation now, all of these challenges with baby boomers being out of the way and all the things that we needed to supply and keep the baby boomers, that large number of us, there was just endless opportunities for people to make money and keep the baby boomers moving and going. And now the whole country was built around making sure that all these people, these baby boomers, and their lifespans and everything was looking up.
Yeah, we made America great until we became we're becoming an albatross around the neck of America, because we're now moving into retirement, we're moving into Social Security needs, we're moving out of the consuming world as we were so actively in it. We were like they described, we were the pig swallowed by the boa constrictor, and we're passing through.
You know, Sandy, it is, and so people are, I guess, starting to realize this now, even though it's kind of late, that because everything in this nation needs to be downsized somewhat.
Here, let's talk about schools responding and solving the problem that they know is impending. What are we doing about Social Security as a nation?
Yeah.
See? So, I mean, this is what people do, is they tend to kick the can a little bit down the road, but they don't wrap their arms around the situation and figure it out.
So here's a prime example, Milwaukee Public Schools. You know, all these major high schools, Sandy, when I was in school, had 2,000 students, right? 2,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those same high schools are still there with 400 students. The buildings were capable of having 2,000 students.
Oh.
But there's not going to be a new baby boom. at some point in time, they're going to have to accept the fact that these buildings that we have, we can't sustain or justify keeping 400 kids and the maintenance and the maintaining of the buildings as if that 400 students at some point in time, there's going to be another 1,600 that are going to be coming into those buildings. But that day is over. When they built all of those schools, we were all children. And so they, in Milwaukee, there were enough people here, and so they had to have those buildings. But that's not ever coming back. Why are they holding on to them? Right?
Yeah. I mean, there are theories about that.
I mean, I know some of the theories. Yeah. But you've got to make the decisions. There's not going to be people to come into those buildings anymore. And you got to let it go.
Well, politically, we don't, like I said on one of the first shows I was ever on, we don't have plans.
Plans, right.
The election cycle doesn't require that we have plans that are long term. The only plans you have to talk about are short term. And I think the best example of how we don't do things that we know are going to happen is like Social Security. We don't really roll up our sleeves. We turn it into a political stalemate in which we scare one another about the alternatives when we could really work it out if we were going to be careful and thoughtful. And we don't tend to do that with things like school districts. Everything gets mired. There's inertia. And particularly in the political world, inertia is the rule of the day, not progress.
Well, you know, we don't want to face the realities. And I think we hurt ourselves long term. Not only do we hurt ourselves, but those who come after us. Because these are decisions that we should be making, that they're going to be forced to have to make, right? If who's in a better position to make these decisions based on the knowledge we have from the years prior that we lived, this is why our generation has to clean this mess up.
We certainly have to participate in cleaning it up. I guess, you know, I think good stewardship would involve the people who are going to experience it playing a role as well, the stakeholders, the real stakeholders who are the people of the future. But yeah, I think the real problem with the baby boomers is we've had a great life and we're pulling the ladder up behind us. Okay. we climbed up into a lofty life and we're pulling the ladder up behind us. We're leaving pretty much of a mess down there behind us of the people who can't get on the ladder.
You know, Sandy, it's a great analogy. It really is, but it's heartbreaking. Because can you, and I always tell people, I can't even envision the mess that people are going to be left with.
Well, 25 inches of rain in one day is maybe a bit of a vestige of a lifestyle that the baby boomers across the world have led. And I, you know, it's more of a question of development, okay? The baby boom generation created a prosperity that grew not only in America but across the world. That prosperity brought with it combustion engines and all the things that were the mark of prosperity. But we better deal with it all.
You know, Sandy, it's why, man, I love having the dialogue and the conversations with you, because again, these aren't discussions that are being had, you know, at the breakfast table, at the lunch table, at the dinner table. And they're not being had almost anywhere in the public, but it is we, the public, who needs to make sure this thing is fixed, right? We've got to get it fixed because it looks like our government's not going to take it on. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, as you ever hear the old axiom that youth is wasted on the young?
Yep. It is.
There's something.
And wisdom is wasted on the elderly.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is you don't realize it until you get there.
I know. Be interesting if you could transfer everything you know to the people who are youthful, and if they could kind of trade you for a little bit of vitality, yeah. Be a good swap.
It really would be, and that's why I think, Sandy, it's so important that, you know, the youth and the elders are connected, right? And that's, we've got to do a better job of getting that wisdom from the elders, because we live in a time, Sandy, where you travel the world. The elders in those places that you go are respected, right?
Well, you know, and I think they are here when we have, you know, you have the voice of the elders. You've coached young people. I coach young people. It's a great connection, and you can feel it. There's a real connection between a teenager and a grandparent kind of a thing. But we've got to have a lot more of it. And we've got to, and I would recommend to everyone who's on the gray end of that scale to participate in it, because I can tell you from firsthand experience, it's the most edifying thing I you can do in your life is to have that relationship, and it even beats parenthood, because the, you know, parenthood's fantastic, but the relationship you have out there by mentoring is kind of unfettered with some of the baggage that parenting carries.
Sandy, it's well said, and you don't need letters behind your name to do that, right?
Absolutely.
There's nothing. You don't need to be wealthy. You don't need to be Jewish. You don't need to be any of those other things. And it's what you get from it, Sandy, I think, is what you were saying, yeah, what you get out of it.
Absolutely. You know, the thing is that you get more than you give. And if people understood that, they'd stop simply reaching in their pocketbook and thinking that they've done all they can do by giving money. And they'd realize that they can do much more, and it would be much better an experience for themselves, okay? It's much better than driving past a building and saying, see my name on that building? I gave that. No, it'd be much better to be involved with all the kids in that building. And I think that's ultimately going to be the solution to at least the societal problems we experience on a metropolitan-wide basis.
Right.
That's going to be the bridge we need to build.
You know, Sandy, it is so rewarding. You know, I see young people. I saw one the other day, and he said, "Hey, are you Mr. Ingram?" I said, "Well," he didn't say it softly because he's a big guy.
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, yeah." He says,
"You said I used to be."
Well, he's looking at all his white hair.
Yeah.
And I said, "Yeah, why?" He says, "Hey, I played in your football league." I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah, I started in it when I was 6 years old." And he said, "I graduated from Ohio State." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, I graduated from Ohio State. I played football."
At Ohio State?
Yeah, at Ohio State. He wasn't a star or anything, but he got to Ohio State, and he was on the team. But more than anything else, Sandy, he graduated. He's got a great job. So to me, you know, and it's not even just for the kids who made it to a higher level, but just knowing that you had some impact in somebody else's life, right?
Yeah. I mean, we can talk about all the other things we talk about. We can talk about what's going on in Ukraine or in Taiwan or whatever. If we all paid so much more attention to what's going on in our backyard, and if we worried about and took care of the young people in America who are the next generation, right? They're the future of America. They're far more important to America than Ukrainians or Taiwanese, right? I mean, I don't mean to diminish the importance of that humanity, but our humanity at home is what we ought to be focusing our attentions on. And we ought to realize that the problems we face will be solved if we solve, if we give every opportunity we can to our youth.
You know, Sandy, so well said, because our parents looked out for us, right?
Yep.
They really did. And I'm not saying we didn't look out for our children, but we can do a better job.
Well, and we can do the job that if there are other parents who aren't looking out for their children, they need to be looked out for, right? Yeah. And we can't, you know, I don't understand us turning our back on a generation of kids who were born places that they don't choose and have all the potential that any child born has. And we ought to make sure that they can fulfill their potential, because if they do, it's good for all of us. And European communities understand this. They understand the benefit of education for everyone, because it benefits everyone in the community. It doesn't just benefit the recipient of education. And we ought to look at it that way. And I can tell you that if you, whatever motivates you into doing it, what you will get out of it will be it will be your own secret pleasure.
And Sandy, it's never too late.
Yep.
Never too late. All right, my friend, it's been great as always. Time went too fast as always.
See you in a couple of weeks. I'm hitting the road.
All right. I don't know how we're going to replace you, man. Oh, I do know.
Oh.
I'm going to bring in CJ. So, yes, we're all exposable.
I'm dumbstruck.
Disposable. We're all disposable. All right, I'll be back.